Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, your host here, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And I've had psychedelic culture on my mind of late. I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago at the Psychedelic Society in San Francisco, which is a very interesting outfit, started a couple of years ago, whose founder, Daniel Jabor, unfortunately died. I never got to meet him, but I did have the opportunity of giving a talk before the group, and that's posted on my fancy new website, technosis.com. And I feel compelled to also mention my the reissue of my book, Hit the Streets, a fancy new cover and a new afterword and a foreword from Eugene Thacker. So there's a lot going on for me right now. It's a very springy spring. And one of the things that I talked about in that talk, psychedelic culture at crossroads, is how much the so-called psychedelic renaissance, really the return to above-ground, licensed, approved psychedelic therapy for both physical and psychological, if not existential, maladies, is really changing the whole discourse around psychedelics in a radical, interesting, and occasionally somewhat troubling way. I think there's a tendency for people who have been interested in the creative and healing potentials of these compounds for a very long time to treat the new softening with just sort of unadulterated glee, the possibility that these things would no longer be legal, people would not wind up in jail, they would not be ostracized for their interests in these things, has produced a kind of enthusiasm for these compounds. But one of the things that I was talking about in my lecture was the way that when discourse change and new groups of people come in with their own agendas and their own need to sort of tell their own story, there's inevitably a process of exclusion whereby the previous group has to be coded and controlled through some kind of way in order to create the space for the new discourse, for the new way of talking and understanding and experiencing, in this case, these compounds. So one of the things that has to happen is that the underground, whatever exactly the underground is, has to be shunted aside. So that crazy, wild, wacky, weird, and somewhat scary zone of countercultural Western psychedelia needs to be kind of put on ice in order to make space for a kinder, gentler, more accessible kind of psychedelic therapy. And, you know, there's a lot of good reasons for that, and there's reasons to be very happy about these changes, about the things that are coming. But I think it's also important to keep in mind the way that these our histories are constantly being rewritten, that it's important to pay attention to that process. And one of the interesting things that's happening in that whole process of the kind of return to psychedelic science is what exactly do we do with all of the information, the anecdotes, the lore, the scientific research, if you will, that went on when all of this was under the board, when it was all illegal. What is science when the state does not approve of the research? That's a very interesting question. Is it science then, or does the state have to approve the research in order for it to be real science? Well, our topic today, I think, is going to raise some of these issues, because we're going to be speaking with Dr. James Penner, who teaches English at the University of Puerto Rico, but has put together a fascinating, really illuminating book called Timothy Leary, The Harvard Years, Early Writings on LSD and Psilocybin with Richard Alpert, Houston Smith, Ralph Metzer, and others. And basically, the book collects together Leary's more scholarly essays, and I think there's a few talks in there as well, but they're mostly journal articles. Some were in the Psychedelic Review, and some of them were in more mainstream journals, but they're definitely Leary writing as scientist, as psychologist, as secular thinker, and you can see the elements of the weirder hippie-ish mad scientist leery to come. But in many ways, these are pretty they're radical, but they're also straightly written articles. And they really raise this very interesting question, which is like, how does this sort of return to psychedelic science, above ground psychedelic science, how is it going to handle the legacy of these crazy characters from the last 40, 50 years, particularly Timothy Leary, who, of course, is all man and no man. And, you know, the greatest trickster, impossible to get to the mask behind the mask behind the mask. He was such a trickster, such a kind of self-invented character, always sort of playing with the situation. And it's tough to assess his legacy, and I think a lot of people want to put him aside. And yet when you turn to these articles, as we'll talk about, when you recover what Leary was thinking about when he was still at Harvard, you realize that a lot of the stuff they're dealing with is exactly the same kind of issues that people are studying today, and in fact that Leary and his co-miscreants came up with that still structure our ideas about psychedelics and the relationship of creativity with the brain, with psychological healing, and so it's very interesting to think about how Leary will play a role in this new renaissance. Well, whether there people will continue to try to demonize him to keep the scary aspects of these things at bay, or whether they will rather come to see that he plays a significant role, not just in culture of underground psychedelia, but in the understanding of psychedelics in a modern Western secular sense as well. But before we bring on Dr. Penner, we'll introduce, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao.
Hi, Eric.
How's Are you
going?
There?
Yeah. Yay. Can you hear me? Yay.
Hey, pretty good. Yeah.
Hey, I really like
squeaky Skype voice.
I know. I really like what you said about like what makes it science, because I've for a long time been a big fan of all mad scientists, right? And it's funny because that idea of how psychedelics can cause a creative opening, I know you and I discussed a lot when we went to the Cameron exhibit, of course, you know, Jack Parsons being one of my favorite mad scientists of all time. But there's this thing of what these characters have. And part of it is deviant and, you know, viewed a little malevolent by culture often. I remember I won the state science fair when I was a little kid because I did this paper on Leonardo da Vinci and how he was basically like cutting up basement bodies at the time. And everyone thought he was completely insane, right? They were like, oh, that weirdo Leonardo, like in his neighborhood, not other people, like, you know, the Pope and stuff like that, were like, oh my God, you're a genius. But all the regular people were like, this guy's a nut job. And similarly, I love tracking those stories of people who get these innovative ideas and then how they have to get that acceptability from the scientific community. And those stories are the most interesting to me to really look at, well, what were these, you know, supposed nefarious characteristics? And a lot of times you'll see those might be what actually led these people to have those kind of breakthroughs. So I love people who include those kinds of shadows in the research of these mad geniuses. Usually that's where you find out, like, you know, where that creative genius opens.
Yeah, that's a great way of introducing the conversation. So with that, let's bring James Penner onto the show. James, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be
Great.
Here.
Great. Yeah, so, I mean, you're a professor of English. This is not exactly a kind of a professor of English collection. I'm curious how you, in terms of your own interests, came to settle on editing these, putting together these essays and kind of, you know, making another claim for, a new claim for Leary in our current era.
Yeah, I guess it's a little unconventional, but basically I'm a literary critic and I, you know, primarily write about writers and literary culture and texts. And when I was writing my dissertation, Pinks, Pansies, and Punks, which looks at the rhetoric of masculinity. I became very interested in the 1960s and the counterculture and Timothy Leary. And he was a part of my chapter, about 10 pages. And the more and more I read, I became fascinated with the Harvard drug scandal of 62 and 63. And so I wanted to collect all of his writings from this historical period, and because I thought it was a really rich cultural moment. And what I found, the more, you know, some of them were available, but some of them were really hard to get, and I had to work with a librarian for a long time and kind of reassemble them. And I found this to be kind of weird, because I felt, the more that I read, that this was really the richest period of his writing, that this was really his most exciting work and his seminal work, and a lot of it was out of print and really hard to get, you know, because most people don't work with a librarian to, you know, track them down. And so I thought, this really needs to be a book, and you know, people need to read his early work again, because it's sort of fallen aside for some reason.
Well, I think for reasons that they're pretty easy to understand in some ways. I mean, it's fascinating to think about the way in which he had to the straight world needed a kind of symbolic scapegoat to kind of carry the growing, you know, sort of interest and demand in these radical substances and radical experiences, and the role. So before talking about some of the texts, and there are some fascinating things in there, including texts that I did not know about, I had not read or even heard about. But before we get to those, let's just kind of review a little bit about why you were interested in that period at Harvard, a little bit about what happened, and then I'd really like your particular opinion on why Leary was sort of so cavalier. You know, here he is, he's at the height of his professional game, you know, working at the greatest university in the United States, although as a Yalie, I do have to kind of call that a little bit, but I'll leave that aside. And then, you know, here he is, and he starts messing around, and, you know, they were, well, however you want to judge it, they were a little fast and loose with their experiments. But what was motivating him at that time? What's going through his mind? How does he make the decision, in some sense, to leave that whole professional game behind him?
Yeah, I think it's a really amazing period, and I think that the whole period of 60 to 63 and Leary's work at Harvard, and I think why it's important is it's a moment when psychedelics were legal, and they were part of the university, they were part of the psychology department, part of science, and there's a different way of thinking, you know, in that particular historical moment, and part of it has to do with a kind of utopianism, which basically these psychedelics are tools that we can understand the mind, and there are no limits to what we can do, and this is, I think, the exciting part of Leary's early work is that utopianism. And then it begins to explode, and I think that there are several reasons for why he gets fired. And I write about that somewhat in my introduction. The one that people aren't so familiar with is Andrew Weil acting as an informer to the Andrew Weil we all know for holistic medicine at the time of when he was 20 years old. Basically informed on Leary and Richard Alpert and one particular student, Ronnie Winston, who had taken psilocybin with Richard Alpert, and that this became a scandal for the Harvard administration and for the president of Harvard, and this creates a kind of movement to fire both of them. And also, there's a lot of tension within the Harvard department itself, because all of the graduate students within the psychology department want to work with Leary rather than the other psychologists. And so that creates a lot of tension and envy. And eventually, I think there's a moment when Leary just decides that he almost seems to welcome being thrown out of the academy. And he doesn't seem to be so worried about his career being destroyed and losing tenure. Well, he actually didn't have tenure yet, but that whole idea of being thrown out of the academy didn't seem to bother him so much in the way that it might bother me or other people now. And I think the answer behind that kind of nonchalant attitude that he had, and even when he got fired, he didn't seem to be so bothered by it, had to do with his experimentation with LSD and his whole idea of game theory, and that being a professor is just another cultural game that I'm playing. It's just a role that I'm playing, and if I can't play this role anymore, I'll play another role. And what's the big deal? You know, I'll create it.
Well, let's talk about that metaphor a bunch, because that's really, really significant to Leary. And it's not just significant to Leary, it ends up being significant throughout the 60s. And while he's by no means the only person to sort of use the metaphor of the game, which also later became kind of the metaphor of the movie, people would talk about getting them into your movie and getting out of theirs, and the sort of notion of a game, a rule set, a sort of social play that was ultimately not quite reality, and yet it was precisely through these games that we created reality or moved through reality. And you know, he uses that in the first essay in the book. How to Change Behaviors, you know, in some ways is one of the essays where it's, or kind of public statements he makes where it's really clear that he's really shifting and that these things have changed his way of organizing psychology, of understanding how people create their worlds. And he talks a lot in that essay about this metaphor of the game. And he doesn't even just mean social games like the professional Harvard psychologist game or the, you know, undergraduate game or the military game, but also he talks about the game of subject and object or the game of ego. So he's expanding this metaphor to really, you know, very large aspects of human experience. Where does that come from? Like, how popular was that at that time? Games people play, that whole notion of the game as a way of organizing an understanding society and perception. Was he taking those ideas from other people, or was he coming up with his own way of thinking through that analogy?
It seems to be a very popular analogy in the early 60s. In a very interdisciplinary way, and it seems to be a term that anthropologists are using, and also Leary, and in that paper, How to Change Behavior, the context of that is really interesting because he's giving it in Denmark, in Copenhagen in 1961, for an international applied psychology a conference, and it's a very big conference at the time with Aldous Huxley and Richard Alpert and a lot of kind of leading figures. And in the room at that time when he's giving that, and this is actually his first paper on psychedelics, even though he had his epiphany experience in 1960, in August of 1960 in Cuernavaca, it's about a year before he actually puts together an article, and this is really the first one. In that conference, it becomes very controversial. Some of the people there, actually some of the Harvard professors, didn't like his talk. And they liked Leary before that. They liked Leary before he did psychedelics, and they were even interested in bringing him to Harvard. But there were certain professors in the audience who see that moment as the moment when he kind of went off the edge, and that they are the same people that are interested in getting him fired 2 years later. And so I think we can see in his early work that even though he's a academic and a scientist and a scholar, his ideas, and he's very, very articulate. I think he's a marvelous writer. And but these ideas are scary to people, even if they come in a scholarly package.
Yeah, well, let's rest on that particular talk then. Like, before he started to, you know, mess around with students and the whole kind of complexity of university politics kicks in. But just as someone presenting ideas to peers, there was something threatening in what he was saying at that time. And what do you think it was? I mean, you mentioned this utopian thinking. There's also a sort of radicalism of the game model as something that we can replay. We can play our own games. There's a kind of almost an anarchist sense of creating another reality, another way of experiencing the world. But again, for me, I read that and it just seems great. It's well spoken. It's full of vim and vigor. You know, it's exciting. What was it that people you think were responding to at the time that where they could see something threatening or dangerous or scary in his stance?
Yeah, I think on sort of two levels. One level is some of them felt he was becoming too kind of evangelical, if I can use that metaphor, in the sense of being a kind of convert and sort of proselytizing about the vision that he had. And so some of them, as materialists and as scientists and sort of hardcore rationalists and behaviorists, they perhaps were a little frightened of that. And then I think on the other level, the kind of radical part that I take away from it is his interest in existential transaction theory, which is the theory that he had to basically take apart the relationship between the psychologist and the patient, and that he wanted to eliminate the hierarchies and just sort of collaborate with the patient. You no longer sort of hide the information that you're taking, your notes. You become a kind of coach for the patient, and it's a sort of more egalitarian way of thinking about therapy. And I think it's very much in Foucault's work and R.D. Lang, and Leary was very much a part of that cultural moment. And so I think that that kind of radical idea of reinventing or in a way demolishing the sort of subject-object, the patient as an object relationship, maybe that was part of what seemed to be radical for some people. And then also, I guess the other thing is that the behaviorists within his department felt that if you're a scientist, you can write about psychedelic drugs in the sense that the patient is the subject, and you can do experiments on the patient, but you yourself, as the scientist, cannot take the psychedelic drugs because they're going to make you no longer objective. And Leary said no, that's a sort of old paradigm, and to really understand psychedelics, you have to take them yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's the kind of rub. I mean, that reminds me again of where he talks about getting beyond the subject-object game, which is, of course, the game that structures science in its most rigorous sense, that you are a mind probing a world of objects, and that if you become sort of participate in the experience yourself, then you've fundamentally broken down this sort of structuring principle of science. And that's one of the things that happens again and again in the discourse around psychedelics. And it's a very interesting one because it wasn't always seen that way. I mean, when we look back at the 18th century, even the early 19th, even the 19th century, at people who are clearly doing what we would now call science, who are approaching it as scientists, they're particularly ones who are dealing with poisons and with different chemical compounds, that they were often would self-experiment. And self-experimentation was part of what it meant to do science. And then it's a certain point in the 20th century where this kind of institutional, professionalized, kind of mechanized structure of creating scientific facts that becomes extremely dangerous. But it's true. There's no way I think you can legitimately do psychedelic science and not know them from the inside to some degree, which doesn't mean you can't be a materialist, highly skeptical, very critical of whatever religious thinking or mystical utopian thinking that some people associate with psychedelic experience. That's not necessary at all. But to not actually have any sort of inside experience is kind of ridiculous. So in some sense, at that point, Leary is already choosing to exit the subject, the strict subject-object game. But what you're saying is that with this existential transactional theory, he was doing it not just because he was having more fun, or that he saw the world as being this magical, mystical place of reality creation, but that within his understanding of psychological process itself, the professor, the psychologist, the one with authority, kind of had to enter into the dance with the person, with the client, with the person who is processing psychological difficulties. So it's already in his thinking that there's a kind of more of a dance or a game that's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with the Concord Prison Project, he is taking the psilocybin pills with the inmates that he's trying to help or reform so they don't go back to prison. And yeah, I think this is a kind of radical movement.
Can you say a little bit more about that experiment and just how it was done? And even there, why did he feel that it was important to take it with the prisoners?
Yeah, I think that his initial work with psychedelics, his first work was with the idea of creativity and the idea that psychedelics make you more creative. And this is what he first explored with a lot of writers and intellectuals and musicians, people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and Aldous Huxley all participated, and they would write reports, and they would basically argue that the psychedelic experience can make you more creative. But the problem with that idea is that there was no way to prove it scientifically in terms of empirical data. And so it kind of became something that was considered, I guess, within his department and within his field, something a little dubious. And so suddenly when he learned about this idea of turning on the prisoners, of reforming the prisoners, he realized that this could be real science. If he could prove that the prisoners are not going to return to prison, this is empirical, you know, data that he can present to the scientific community. And so I think he was attracted to it for that reason, that people would take him seriously, that they wouldn't just brush off his research. And I think within that experiment of going into the Concord prison and working with inmates, I mean, it was a little scary at first, you know, tripping with the inmates, and you get a sense of that from his writings. But also, I think he initially was able to have a lot of success, and certainly the people that participated in the project were really, really enthusiastic about it. And I think he develops a model of catharsis, right, where the inmates and the prisoners basically have a catharsis experience that they don't want to return to prison, and that they want to fundamentally change who they are, and they don't want to play the cops and robbers game anymore. And I think what's really interesting is this catharsis model of, well, Leary's arriving at it in 61, 62. That's precisely what science now in a lot of the FDA-approved studies, that they're using the catharsis model now for patients to maybe give up alcoholism or give up nicotine or some sort of therapeutic experience that they're having, you know, is based on what Leary was discovering at a very early moment. And I guess the only real difference, and I guess you could argue that Leary's version of patient-centered therapy was radical in the sense that the therapist is tripping with the patient at the same time. And I don't know that in any of the scientific studies that's the case right now. But I guess that maybe is the difference with Leary's use of it in 1961.
Sure. Yeah, that seems to that makes a lot of sense. I think these days that's just not even really discussed. Except what you want, of course, is a facilitator who's familiar with the spaces and is able to create, you know, a good setting for the situation. In a sense, the therapist going along for the ride is a bit more of a shamanic structure. Where there's sort of an interaction between these different world-creating psyches, and it will be interesting to see whether that, you know, that becomes the new underground, is the therapists who are unwilling to stay straight during the thing. But we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking to James Penner about the early Timothy Leary. Fascinating stuff. Really, really worthwhile for people interested in these. In these topics, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds, the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with James Penner today about Timothy Leary. You know, it's so funny, Eric, before the break, you guys were talking about that shamanic nature of Timothy Leary wanting to participate in the thing. And it's so funny because that really is what Gnostics are, and Gnosticism, because the Gnostics were ones who knew by experience or by knowing or by doing. And there's that whole thing in the Bible, the word to know is like an intercourse with the thing. Like, you got to get up in it. Like, to know something, you have to participate. And that concept, it's like, what if all cancer doctors had actually survived having cancer? Or, like, I had an experience with that when I went to have a baby and my gynecologist was a man, and I was like, I kind of really want a woman gynecologist who's had a baby to help me through this. So it's so funny how people in our society today we kind of, like, it's okay to read about things or know about them, but no one really wants to know by doing kind of concept. And that brings me, I wanted to ask you, James, about how do you feel, I know it seemed radical in the United States what Timothy Leary was doing psychologically, but if we look at Freud, I mean, Freud did this whole work on the patient, you know, and the counselor relationship. I know, Eric, we had Makita Brotman on the show a while ago, and she wrote this book, Phantoms in the Clinic, where she talks about Freud's work with that. And he kind of really did a lot of the same things. And for him, he did it on cocaine, of course. So he was using, instead of LSD, cocaine as a sort of facilitator. And then, of course, there was all the scandal, and then Jung got in on it, and then there was all the stuff with the ladies, which was a little similar to Timothy Leary. So I was wondering, like, how do you feel about, like, Freud as a prototype for some Leary stuff? And has anyone made any comparisons with stuff like that you know of? Or did you find out any information about that in the course of your studies?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I think it's actually really central to Leary's early writing, because in the late 50s and in the early 60s, he was very much a critic of psychoanalysis, and he felt that psychoanalysis didn't work very well, and that it needed to be reformed or revolutionized. And so this is initially existential transaction theory that he comes up with in the late 50s, before he even does psychedelics, is very much a critique of the Freudian model.
Right.
And the interesting thing, I think, about the difference here is Freud's conception of the unconscious, which is a very negative conception, that there are these sort of base desires that the unconscious entails, and basically the id, which is sort of power hungry and lustful, and in every way terrible, and. And that Leary didn't agree with that idea at all, and that for Leary, I would say he was much more Jungian, in the sense that that the unconscious was this remarkable entity to explore and to embrace, and that psychedelics become a means of accessing the unconscious. And certainly Freud didn't want to do that.
But see, it's funny because a lot of people don't know about some of Freud's late. I think Freud is kind of a little bit of a victim, like Leary gets, where he is known for his scientific work, and then some of his ideas get left out a lot of the times because he was very interested in psychic and subconscious work, but he never kind of, I mean, to my knowledge, because he mentioned on his deathbed he wanted to explore it more. But then it's funny because he almost won scientifically and didn't get fired because he wouldn't put that in his papers. And maybe that's like what made Leary such a superhero, is he just went ahead and like was very open and was, you know, free with all of his thinking. He was really just a free thinker that wouldn't let the kind of like, you know, educational system impede on his thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I think one way to read Leary is as a kind of a critic of psychoanalysis, and then initially that is his work at Harvard, and then eventually he gets thrown out of the academy, and he needs to kind of reinvent himself when he's no longer an official psychologist and an official professor, and so he begins to explore, you know, all these different ways of thinking and other identities.
I think one of the interesting questions about him, and I'm still unresolved, is, you know, sort of his first move after Harvard is sort of towards the spiritual, towards the Eastern mystic. You know, he writes The Psychedelic Experience, which draws from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Then he writes Psychedelic Prayers, which draws from Lao Tzu. Then he writes High Priest, which is an amazing book that people don't read enough. That's sort of about that hinge period, and it's wonderfully written too. It's one of his best books. I mean, the thing about Leary is that sometimes a lot of these figures, it's funny that if they become notorious in some sense, people just sort of forget that whatever else they are, they're writers, and that you can read their books. And, you know, in the case of Leary, he's a really good writer. Not always, but often. And just as a writer, he's a powerful figure, and the sort of need to kind of drag him down in different ways that people often have just kind of often ignore that. But the question I ask myself is that how much he was, you know, maybe it's an impossible question, how much was he really turning to the spiritual in the sense that he thought that the spirituality and Gurdjieff and all this stuff held truths about the human experience that were not available in more secular understandings, and how much he was just kind of riding it, you know, how much he was just playing with the languages that seemed to resonate, because his connection of psychedelic experience and Tibetan mysticism in the Tibetan book of in the Psychedelic Experience, you know, 1964. Even though we look at that book now and it's real creaky and very dated in a lot of ways, that fundamental connection was incredibly important for the counterculture to come. That the idea that taking psychedelic drugs, which 10 years before were largely considered to be either, you know, ways of modeling psychosis or ways of programming behavior or truth serums, you know, from MK Ultra, that 10 years later they provide either direct or resembling experiences to high states of Eastern mysticism. That's a very peculiar and rapid transformation that has enormous consequences for spirituality, for yoga. All this stuff is bound up with that. And so I always kind of wonder about Leary's move towards the spiritual, towards the guru, towards the wisdom of the masters, away from a more kind of psychological, even a Jungian register, which, as you say, he has that Jungian element, but he doesn't really go that deep down that pathway. He kind of forges his own way. And so I'm curious how, since you're looking at texts that are right on the verge of that transformation, how you see his sort of next period following these writings.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think first of all, initially he's an atheist and a materialist and a behaviorist, and then when he has his first experience with magic mushrooms in Cuernavaca, it really opens his mind, and he sees that there's a whole nother reality that perhaps science or a sort of materialistic point of view isn't really understanding. And so he, even though he's sort of the last person to have a religious experience, he suddenly does, and he suddenly becomes really interested in mysticism, I think because it has a way of describing things that science doesn't really understand very well. You know, how do you describe an epiphany, you know, in scientific terms? There isn't much of a in fact, science is skeptical of epiphanies, and because they're considered to be too subjective and not scientific and so on. And so Leary, I think he's attracted to mysticism precisely because it can describe these things that science isn't very good at describing. And I think he wants to be a scientist and be a mystic at the same time. And in a sense, he's kind of postmodern in that sense, that these are sort of different cultural games, and that he can inhabit, you know, different cultural perspectives at the same time, that there's this kind of multiplicity that is possible. And so I think that's how Leary comes to mysticism, just because it has a way of describing these experiences in a way that science cannot. And then as he's thrown out of the academy and when he's no longer officially a psychologist and when he writes High Priest, I think he is at that point kind of playing with the role of being a guru and a spiritual thinker, playing in the sense of, kind of inhabiting the role. It's a kind of social construction. It's a kind of myth, and it's powerful. And I think he enjoys it. And it's even kind of funny because, you know, because of what he was before he ever took psychedelics. And so I think there is always an element of play involved in Leary the mystic and Leary the spiritual thinker, and that he's not fully committed to it, but I do think he sees it as a you know, it's a very rich tradition that is really interesting to explore it, and certainly in terms of psychedelics.
Yeah. Do you know, or did you find out how did like the people at Harvard react when they found out that he was becoming this mystic guru? Like, I wonder if that had what kind of repercussions that had on people that had worked with him before. Like, did that create more division? Did they just ridicule him, or were some of the Harvard people like more accepting of that? Do you know anything about how that reaction was taken among that Harvard community?
I think it created some tension, and that they felt that the word they use a lot is that he's become a cultist. Mm. That, you know, he's establishing a religious cult. And of course he wasn't. He wasn't forcing anybody to do anything. He wasn't coercing anyone. You know, it wasn't a cult. But that's initially how they described it. And in my book, there's actually a very sensationalist article, you know, written about the Harvard drug scandal that I've reproduced from 1963, called the Hallucinogenic Drug Cult, that kind of has that rhetoric of Leary as a cultist. So I think it created a lot of tension. But at the same time, I think Leary really enjoyed that too. He enjoyed kind of pissing off his colleagues and making them upset, and that's something that he had always done throughout his life, from high school and beyond. He had always made cultural and educational authorities very nervous, and he clearly enjoyed doing that. I guess we could use the British phrase, taking the piss out of them, and that's something that that he's done ever well before he ever took psychedelics. He was taking the piss out of cultural authorities, and so I think it was problematic for them. The Harvard authorities, and they felt that they needed to fire him and kick him out.
So we have about we got about a little bit less than 10 minutes, and I wanted to turn to the topic of how you believe Leary should be engaged now in terms of the questions and research that's going on in the psychedelic renaissance. And before you answer, I just want to point out one kind of irony that people do not really mention, which is the by far and away the most consistent idea about psychedelics in the history of their modern reception. You know, as I mentioned, in the 50s, it's like LSD. Does it model psychosis? Is it a truth serum? Does it enhance creativity? Does it help psychology? Does it drive people crazy? Is it a mind control? You know, all of these different, what is this thing? How do we categorize it? And, but the most consistent idea about these things is the ideas of set and setting, that the mind frame and the immediate environment and the kind of cultural environment around these things makes a fundamental difference in terms of the nature of the experience and its short-term and long-term effects. And this is, of course, Leary's idea, and it structures even contemporary research. So when you read about the John Hopkins experiments with psilocybin, you know, they describe the room and they use Bach and they have flowers and, you know, they try to transform the ugly institutional setting into something that would be supportive of a positive experience. So some of this stuff is like absolutely ingrained into the fundamental ways in which we think about and study psychedelics, but it's kind of hidden. People don't say, and as Leary taught us, set and setting, you know. And so I'm curious for you, riff on that, or in addition to that, what do you think are the most important things that Leary, and particularly this early work that you've collected, has to say to today's psychedelic researchers?
Yeah. I think, first of all, people need to read Leary's early work, that for a long time it just wasn't available, and people mainly read Leary's work from maybe the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and that was the Leary that they were familiar with. And frankly, his later work is just not as good and as seminal as his early work is really the most amazing work he did, really 60 to 65. And so I think, first of all, they need to actually read it. And so my book is a way of kind of getting his work out there again. And then I suppose there are certain, you know, institutional forces where they might, if they're trying to get FDA approval, they might not want to mention his name too much, you know, because he tends to have a bad reputation in the sense of being, I guess the stereotype is that he is irresponsible in some way in terms of being a researcher, and so they tend not to give him credit. But I think now, sort of 50 years later, after the Harvard drug scandal and after, you know, everybody that was involved, most of the people have died, at least the professors that, you know, were directly in his department, that you know, we need to read his work again. And really, if you want to form an opinion about him, you should read his early work. And then we can have a discussion about it. But that for a while there, I just don't think that his early work was out there. As far as his relevance for right now, I think there are a lot of people that have been reading this book and are amazed at how much work he did. And my book does not have all the stuff that he did between 60 and 65. I couldn't publish it all because I didn't want to publish a 600-page book that nobody would want to read or buy. And so I had to make some cuts just because I wanted something that, you know, that people would buy. And so I think that I've had people like Charles Grobe at UCLA, and some people had told me that he might not like the book or that he wouldn't, you know, want to write a blurb for me. But I actually sent him the book, and he wrote a marvelous blurb for me. And he was very enthusiastic about reading Leary's early work. And so I think I think there is a lot of people just don't realize how much he did and what a good writer he was, and they had no idea, and that this is something that this is a rich cultural moment that people need to be aware of, and I think if they read The Doors of Perception, and as the sort of first generation of psychedelics, then they need to read Larry's early work in the Harvard years as kind of like the second generation of psychedelic thinking, and that it's really crucial. Really, you can't just sort of skip over it.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I would say that also about the Joyous Cosmology, Watts's book, which is recognized and people refer to it, but it has nowhere near the status of the Doors of Perception, and in some ways I think it's actually a better book, a more illuminating book. I mean, you know, obviously Huxley is a genius and it's an amazing book. I've read it so many times. But I do think that this early 60s moment in some ways is even more important. And what I like about both Leary and Watts in different but not totally dissimilar ways is the way in which they balance an essentially non-supernatural view of the physical body embedded in nature, embedded in experience, thrust into social games, you know, a non-mystical or non-religious way of understanding our condition, our existential condition. And then they open that up to these forms of experience that lead into mystical, religious, metaphysical questions. But they occupy this space in between. And I think this space in between is increasingly where a lot of us find ourselves. And so it's actually in these sort of secular wrestlings with the possibility of religious experience that I think is a part of the value of these texts lie in. That it's precisely by Leary's need to still speak a kind of secular language that increases the value of these in compared to later popular writings, where he's able to just kind of, you know, give the people what they want and play to their fantasies as well as their dreams. And there's interesting things there too, but there's something more, the additional rigor here reflects our condition, I think, even more in our, you know, highly, highly technological, highly, you know, mediated society right now, where there's a lot less room for that, those kinds of fantasies or those kinds of utopias, really.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, Leary's conception of the psychedelic experience is really this idea of if we could talk about aesthetic enlargement and sort of making you more receptive in every way. I think this is a kind of very exciting way to look at life and everything. And this is what I guess it's more about multiplicity and less about a dogma or sort of fixed way of thinking that you might get in a religious tradition.
Wonderful. Well, James, I think we're going to have to end it there. Again, the book edited by Dr. James Penner is Timothy Leary, The Harvard Years, Early Writings on LSD and Psilocybin, with a bunch of familiar characters. And I really do highly recommend it. I spent the last couple of years familiarizing myself with some of this material and early Leary, and I think it's absolutely pivotal to people, for people interested in these topics. There's a lot more to talk about. So thank you very much, James.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Great. All right. So for me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open. Mm-hmm.